and I'm here with Tanya Brown. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, everyone. Hi, Randy.
Hi, I love your button, accept your greatness.
Isn't that awesome? Yeah, I did a speaking engagement today, and they gave me that button.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to borrow and take it home. And
you got it. I'll give it to you.
The family says. Just shut up. All right. Well,
it's a positive affirmation.
Yeah.
Right?
We all need that. We had Jerry Jewell on. Mm-hmm. That was epic.
Yes.
And we'd love to have her back. But in talking to Jerry later, she said, you know, you have got to interview my mm-hmm. friend who is our guest, Kathy Buckley.
Yep. and we haven't even gotten going yet, and we've just been laughing our tails off.
Yeah, I hope we didn't already blow all our jokes. No. Hey, Kathy, seriously,
this is great.
Glad to have you here. Now, for those who don't know you, you are a comedian. You're a big deal. You're very successful, big name in Southern California and beyond. But the first question I got for you is just introduce yourself and start at the very beginning and let people know who you are from the start of things.
Okay, well, when I was in my mother's vagina,
I knew this was where it was going to go.
I could have stopped with my dad's phone, okay? No, I started a little later. When I was born, I was born RH negative, and they didn't get the blood to me fast enough. Apparently, you're supposed to get a blood transfusion within 24 hours, and we went to Air Force Base, and they didn't get the blood to me fast enough, so the priest came in, gave me my last rites, and they told my mother I probably won't make it. Then they did get the blood to me, but they also told both my parents that I was going to be slow because of the delay of the blood. And then when I got spinal meningitis when I was about 3, when you can start really talking, the doctor said she's going to probably be slow. And they did give my last rites to me again, a spinal meningitis, which is really bizarre. Apparently nobody wants me here. But I was put in school for retardation because now my parents' belief system is that I'm slow. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the things I don't like about people who don't know who you are and you're not living in my shoes, making judgment and labels and labeling individuals. Mm-hmm. But back then, you know, there was a lot of ignorance, not knowing. So then I was 8 years old when they found out I had a hearing loss. And they called me slow.
So from birth to 8, nobody knew that you were hearing impaired.
No, the thing that was hard for them to understand was, you know, like if somebody doesn't have their hands, they know how, learn how to use their feet. Well, I use my eyes. Mm. I could tell by facial expressions that with a question. I could tell by, you know, what they wanted. And I was lip reading. So I was the self-taught lip reader. That was my survival mechanism. So they couldn't understand why I can react to something but not speak it. Mm-hmm. And so that was the confusing part of it. And that's why they figured I was hearing because I was reacting but not speaking it. So when they found out I was deaf, they put me in another school that I pray to the high heaven that every child meets a teacher like my Miss Joan Daly. Mm. She taught me how to talk. No, and we have.
How old were you?
It's amazing.
At this 8. Point? 8. Okay.
Yeah, 8 years old. And then she taught me how to talk, and we haven't found a teacher to teach me how to shut up. Still making up for those 8 years.
I think that's kind of impossible, don't you think?
I'm going to give it a try.
Okay. And so she was amazing. I was in her class with one other student, Michael. We both had the same hearing loss, and she used to tell us, every Friday, if you do your very best, I would take you out for hamburgers, french fries, and a milkshake. And Michael and I, we would bust our lips just to get that information there. And every Friday, this amazing teacher had both of us in this restaurant having hamburgers, french fries, and a milkshake. And we would look at each other like, what are you doing here? She never wanted us to do better than the other one. She just wanted us to have the best of our own self. She was amazing. And I loved this woman because she was the first person that I made a connection with. And because of that connection, I hated the weekends. I did not have that connection with my family. And so when Monday mornings would come, I would run into the classroom, drop my coat off on the floor, run up to Miss Joan Daly, and I would tell her everything that happened that weekend in my best speech possible. I was spitting on this lady.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit because you covered a lot of territory there. When did you realize, what's your earliest memories, and when did you realize that maybe you had an issue that other kids weren't dealing with?
To be honest with you, I didn't know. I did not know I had a hearing loss. When the authorities came in and put on this big harness with the battery pack and wires to my ears. But when you're deaf and you don't have language, you can't explain to a child with a hearing loss why they have to wear it. Mm. Now, if somebody's leg is missing, you could see that their leg is missing, but you can't see sound missing. Mm-hmm. So the confusion was, why did they put this device on me? And why is it painful? Because it was loud and it hurt my ears. It wasn't made for my particular loss. And so I thought I was being punished for a long time.
Oh. And how old was, when did they do that?
They did that when I was about 9, when they gave me the hearing device.
Oh. So before, from birth to 8, when you had this wonderful teacher, could you hear anything?
I hear sound, but it's like Mazo sound, like if you're talking.
Okay.
So lip reading is my primary connection to this world.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's, still today?
Pardon?
Not still today.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, even with my hearing device, I can hear okay, but my eyes will always be my connection because I don't trust sound. Mm. I don't trust sound. Okay. I don't trust what I hear because it's easily misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. The English language has too many words, one word with too many meanings. So reading the facial expressions and reading lip and body language, mm-hmm. you can get the whole story.
So when Jerry was on our show.
Yeah, I never liked her.
Well, I love her. So, but that's
she's my sister.
I'm like,
hey, one of these times before the time is over with, I have to tell you about Jerry because it's her fault that I got into this business.
Well, we'll get there.
We'll get there.
But Jerry was grew up in Fullerton, where I grew up, just north of here. And Jerry, unfortunately, very sadly, was bullied in mm-hmm. school. Did you go through that kind
of garbage? Yes.
I mean, to the extent you're comfortable.
I got locked in closets. When I was young, because my eyes and my ears, I've become what you call a chameleon. Mm-hmm. You copy everybody to fit in. You just want to be a part of something.
Sure.
You know, you want to be accepted.
Sure.
And I would just copy people. And people do it without a hearing loss, whether it's the fad of tattoos or right. clothes or, yeah. you know, keeping up with it. But I would actually pick up a lot of things from the kids around me. And the majority of my friends were Black because we were both being rejected from society over something we had no control over. Mm. So, in fact, it was really great because this past week when I was in Ohio, I met my friend Lisa. Both of us hit 6 foot tall in sixth grade. She's Black. I'm a little pale. And she's my sister. And we got together and it was like being 16 years old all over again with our innocence and learning about life together. So, I forgot what your question was. Isn't it nice getting old?
Yeah, it's just good. It's all good. We're having a conversation. No, this is fun.
Well, so you were bullied and you found that our Black friends and neighbors were the people that you like to mm-hmm. hang out with.
Yeah, I would never, a lot of kids have their group of people they hang out with. I was involved in all the kids in school. I don't know why, but, one of my teachers, Mr. Hint, who I loved with all my heart. He was a biology teacher. I never forget the day I walked into the classroom and they had a frog pinned to this styrofoam thing. And this little frog legs and arms are up in the air and I'm looking at the frog and I'm going, this kid ain't going anywhere. And so I see that the kid next to me went to slice it open because we were supposed to dissect the frog, but I didn't understand what was going on in the class. And I looked at Mr. Hanson, he saw the fear in my face and he just went like this. He turned his head and he's for me to get out of the classroom because he wasn't going to make anybody do something they didn't want to do. Mm. Nobody knew my hearing loss in high school, including me. After sixth grade, it was just on my own. And then Mr. Hint got me the camera for the yearbook. And I ended up being the photographer for the yearbook. Mm. And that gave me credibility. Mm-hmm. That gave me significance. And so, and it was great because whether they was filming the camera or not, you know, everybody who saw me with the camera, it was the same pose.
The selfie really, back in the day.
I know. I go, really? Can't you come up with something new? And so he gave me, and I told him, I said, I don't write well. I didn't get an education in school. I got a fourth grade reading level up max. And I told him, he said, you wanted me to be the editor of your book in my 12th year. And I said, Mr. Hintz, there's just no way. I can't write and spell. And he goes, he taught me how to delegate. Mm-hmm. He taught me how to get the people who know how to write. Tell them what you want to write. He taught me how to do that. And it's interesting because he taught me how to ask for help, which is not an easy thing for me to do. I'm a very independent person. Mm-hmm. But he was like a dad to me that I didn't have. And so he was amazing. And so, but all through high school, I think I tried committing suicide about 5 times.
Ooh.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I didn't want to be here.
So there's a lot of, while you're trying to fit in your words being a chameleon, there's a lot of inner pain going on.
There's no identity.
Yeah.
There's no identity. There's no truth to who I am. I didn't feel a connection with my family. I did. I lost Miss McJoan Daly when she would, when I had to leave to go to public school. I lost Michael. So there was no more connection. Mm. In public school, the teacher had their back to us as she's drawing on the blackboard. The kids would talk in the classroom. And by the time we find their lips, somebody else's lips are moving. And I graduated with a 1-point average. Mm. And nobody bothered to tell me we were collecting points.
Darn it. That's tough. That's a rough start.
With an emptiness.
A loneliness. I mean, that's what puts you, you know, you, me, right?
Yeah.
And many other people, it's that sense of loneliness. We can be alone. We can be, you know, but it's the second that you get into the loneliness piece, that's where you start going down.
Well, yeah, you don't, who do you turn to? Who do you talk to? And I couldn't go to my parents. We didn't have connection.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that. Tell us, to the extent that you're comfortable, tell us about your family. And do you have siblings? And what, tell us about what that all looked like.
Two ugly brothers.
Okay.
They're adorable.
How?
I love my brothers. I love my brother. I'm a middle child. My mother's from Italy. And my dad from England. The family. And there was just hardworking middle-class people. And back then, you know, they say you put this hearing device on them, they're fixed like a pair of glasses. Well, it's not how it works with hearing devices. Hmm. You know, it's not you put on hearing aids and all of a sudden you can hear, because by the time I'm 8 years old, that part of my brain has atrophied. Hmm. I needed training. And not only that, but usually by the time you're 5, your brain learns to receive and hold on to information. Hmm. I didn't have that opportunity. Because now I'm learning a language at 8. And that's a long time to wait to learn about connection. About anything. Love, connection, any of it. Mm-hmm. So I think the loneliness was that I wasn't get what most people get with connection. Mm-hmm. You know, hearing people like my godchild, I never forget, I was talking to her. She's doing her homework in front of a TV. Her mother has a radio on in the kitchen. Her mother's talking to her. And I'm going, how the hell do you do that? I was astounded, and Julia's answering her. I can't understand how somebody can talk to somebody from another room, because I need to see your face. Mm-hmm. And I just assume other people do too. So I guess I'm just grateful that I didn't succeed in the suicidal attempts. But my parents, they just worked hard. They didn't know, my mother didn't know how to connect. My dad didn't know how to connect. My mom and dad didn't have a connection. Mm-hmm. And it was just those days where people got married because you're supposed to get married, you're supposed to have a family. You're following society's rules and regulation instead of creating your own individual thought. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. There was just no connection.
And that's where so your loneliness didn't even come in during high school. It came in from like childhood.
Oh yeah. My brother Mark was the same way. He was suicidal also.
Mm. So
it was just not having that connection. It would have been nice if you go home from school, excuse me, and your parents would say, so how was your day today? What did you learn today? I remember one time I was sitting at the kitchen counter and my dad was helping me with the homework. I knew the answer, but I was afraid to tell him in case it was wrong. And so I kept holding it in, holding it in. He goes, why are you so stupid?
He would say that to you?
Yeah. Because he was frustrated that I wasn't answering him. And it stuck with me. And I thought, oh man, because I was in school for not too smart kids. And, you know, you start questioning yourself. And it was just hard. Connection is the number one thing that I believe everybody wants in life.
Absolutely. And that's kind of, that's what Jerry was also talking about, right? For the first, how many years that, because she, with her disability, like, oh, if we hug her, if we hold her, she could break or, you know, I may get what you have or whatever, but she didn't have that human connection either. So I can only imagine now your brothers, they're fine with their hearing and physically.
Oh yeah, they're fine. They're just ugly.
So they're so fun. So it just shows you how important human connection is, hearing or not.
It is. Everything. Look at our babies that are growing today.
Yeah.
The same thing. A lot of them are not having that connection because both parents have to work and everybody's exhausted by the time they come home. Mm-hmm. And it's like, get these kids to bed so we can have some peace of mind. And I don't care what you're going through in life, but please always talk to your kids. But more importantly, listen to them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Listen to them.
Yes.
You know, I know we're talking about some rough stuff, but 5 suicide attempts, that's a lot.
That's a lot.
I'm not very good at it, apparently.
Me neither.
Well, good thing you're not.
Me neither.
Yeah. I'm not there yet, but some days.
I teach you, Randy. I teach you. Okay. I'm here to aim to please.
Wow. Okay. Well, not to change the subject. What was going... We all have our issues, but that has not been one for me. But what's going through your head? Explain to somebody like me, somebody who's never even gone there, like, hey, I really want to cash in my chips and commit suicide. What's going through your head in those dark moments?
That's the thing, Randy. Nothing's in your head. Mm-hmm. Nothing's in your head. Nothing's in your heart. Your soul is almost like diminished. I mean, this body holds on to my soul. I wasn't feeding it anything. It wasn't getting love. It wasn't getting connection. It wasn't getting appreciation. It wasn't getting any kind of significance or appraisal. So I think it's the emptiness. It's not like in your mind you're going, yeah, I think I want to check out. It's just, you're so empty. There's just no reason to be here. Mm-hmm. There's just nothing here.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you when with the first suicide attempt?
How was I? I was in high school. I was in high school. I think it was the first one was, I think it was 9th grade.
So 14?
Because of a home economic issue.
Okay.
And that I know I wasn't doing good in school. And I love home economics. I can make anything. And it was the only way I can get the chocolate chip cookies anyway. But I never forget the teacher who I did like. And she said, I don't know if you guys remember the old days when they had those toilet paper dolls with a crocheted skirt you put on it. Remember those?
Yes.
Mm. Well, she said, you need to make one of these paper doll covers or you can make 2 placemats by the end of 6 weeks. Well, I turned it around and I thought she wanted 6 of them at the end of the week. Well, I stole all my mother's toilet papers. Well, and I made 6 of them that weekend. I just crocheted my little butt off. And I was so proud of myself because I thought, yes, I'm doing something right for the first time. And I came in Monday and I put them all on her desk. I was so proud of myself. She gave me the dirtiest look. One, she didn't think I did it. 2, she says, what is this? And I go, it's my project. And she says, well, why do you have so many? And I said, because you said to have 6 of them by the end of the week. And she said, no, and you're supposed to have 1 at the end of 6 weeks. And I'm going, oh, I didn't know. She said, well, what are you supposed to do for the rest of the 5 weeks? Like, make plate math? I didn't know. But I was always getting rejected because I misinterpreted. Mm. If you're depending only on size for, you know, lip reading is what, guessing 75% of the conversation. Mm-hmm. So I just kept getting, I ended up in the principal's office, not knowing why. They thought I was being sassy, but I wasn't. I was trying to figure out what's going on. So it's just that. So at that time, I was suicidal because I knew then I did not fit in. No matter how much I played the game to fit in, I wasn't going to fit in.
So all kids want to fit in, and you just weren't getting that connection with anybody, your family, or at school, or anywhere in life.
The only person I connected with was my grandma and grandpa.
Hmm. Tell us about them.
Yeah.
They were awesome. They were awesome. Grandpa was quiet. He was mischievous. And he would always tease me. But what he did to this day still fascinates me. He would get me in trouble all the time. He would get, you know, like, he'll take my grandmother's lipstick and write on the mirror in the bathroom. My grandmother didn't suspect grandpa. She suspected me. Mm-hmm. And then I get yelled at and get punished and go into her bedroom and be punished. And we kept doing these stupid little things. He even put a bead inside of, you know, those old pressure cookers. It exploded. And I didn't hear it. But apparently grandmother did. Got punished again. Now, I knew in my heart that grandpa loved me. You could tell in his eyes. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't understand why he kept doing that. So one time I got punished and I'm in the room. He didn't know about my hearing loss. He knew there was something different about me. And so what happened was I got punished, ended up in the room. So what I did is I took all my grandmother's underwear out of her drawers and put all my grandfather's underwear in that drawer and replaced them. I switched all their clothes out. I got bored. Well, grandma never thought I did that. And grandpa got yelled at.
Payback, baby.
Yeah.
That's and a cute story.
After that, grandpa never did anything like that again with me. But when I got older, I asked him, I said, why? Why'd you do that? Why were you doing that? I know you love me. He goes, honey girl, nobody spoke about what was that was different about you. But I knew I needed to make sure that you could protect yourself. He goes, there are going to be people who are going to love you and still mess with you. And there are going to be people who are not going to like you, but you're going to learn to make sure that you take care of yourself first and foremost.
Hmm.
And so I had to get grandma new lipstick.
All right.
He was T.E.O. Oh, go ahead. Well, he was teaching you, you know, I mean, it's really sad and it's funny how sometimes everything in hindsight, it's like, okay, now that's why you did that. But when I was going through it, it was such hell, you know? So he was, you know,
I thought it was some kind of a game. Honestly, I didn't take it, you know, like, you know,
seriously,
it was just a game. I mean, grandma used to buy me these, I don't know if you remember those old cardboard things where you push the yarn through the hole and stuff like that, like arts and crafts stuff. And my mother would say, don't give her that. She won't know what to do with it. And I would sit and grandma would have her legs open and I would sit on the floor between her legs and she just make sure I did it. So I got really good at crocheting, knitting, sewing. I mean, anything to be creative. I'm very crafty that way. Mm-hmm. And those are little seeds that she planted in me,
mm-hmm.
you know? And it's funny because grandma never knew how to do any of those things. And so when she was older, she asked me to teach her how to crochet. So I'm trying to teach her and I'm looking at her. I go, aren't you supposed to be teaching me this? And it was just, that was my only connection I had with my grandparents. That was my pride and joy.
Where were they living when you were growing up? Were they nearby?
Not far.
Yeah.
They came over. Mom had them over. That was my dad's parents.
Uh-huh.
She had them over every holiday. Every Friday night, we would go down to their place and we would eat dinner there. And so we were close.
Yeah.
Well, and somebody like you, and I don't want to break the timeline, but you end up as a well-known comedian, a lot of success. You end up working with Tony Robbins and other big names. We'll get there. But people, when they see you on stage and when people see you working with, you know, other well-known people, they don't realize the struggle you went through where that was completely unknown. I mean, going back to your childhood, I got to ask you this, and you know, you decide what you want to share, but I know there was some abuse, which is very, very ugly. And Jerry shared some of that. What are you comfortable in sharing about that?
Well, I have no problem sharing anything. If it helps somebody else get out of the rut, yeah. I'm here for you.
Great. Great. Amen. Thank you.
My dad was molesting me. My mom went to work every Saturday morning. She worked as a cashier in a grocery store. And it got to the point where Saturday mornings, my dad would sneak into either the bathroom or the bedroom, wherever I was. I didn't like what he was doing to me. And so he was molesting me. And then I started wearing my clothes in bed on Friday nights. And I would not go to sleep. I'd wait for the bathroom light to click on for when my mom's going to get ready for work. And I snuck out of the house. I would take a bunch of bread and crackers with me. And I would go down to the wooded area and I would feed the squirrels. I wasn't too happy when the skunks came around. Made me a little nervous. But... But the squirrels I like. And so, because we lived not far from a golf course. And so it got to the point where it's like the lesson that my grandfather taught me. I need to still take care of myself. I don't need to be there. My brother would be downstairs watching cartoons. And so we were alone upstairs. So it messed me up. It messed me up big time.
How old were you when this was going on?
But that was the weird part. I was between 12 and 13, I think, or maybe 14. My body was starting to change. And I knew nothing. Nobody taught me about you're going to get boobies or you're going to get pubic hairs or whatever have you. And I thought I was going to grow a dick, but that never happened. But I have to say, I got more balls than most of the men I know. I have to tell you that. But I didn't know anything. So I'm scared of my body right now because nobody's telling me anything. Like the first time you get your period, I thought I was dying. And it was my friend Lisa that I spoke about earlier that she told me, I told Lisa, Lisa, I'm dying. She says, why? And I told her I was bleeding. And she says, no, Kathy, you go, that's going to happen for the next 50 years every month. And I'm going, I thought you were my friend. You know, I was like, ew. And I didn't understand because, you know, they did have a an animated video where the mother and daughter were supposed to wash and they had the sperm going up the tube. Well, I thought it was a tadpole. I'm waiting for a frog to develop and this baby kept getting away. So I had no idea what they were talking about with sex. I knew none of that stuff. It is amazing when you have a hearing loss, how you miss out in life. Because all the stuff that I should have known ahead of time, I didn't. So I didn't even understand what my dad was doing to me.
Yeah.
And this was the person who took me for my hearing test. He took me to this speech, to this little old lady who had blue hair. She was supposed to teach me how to read. She was supposed to tutor me. But I was so fascinated with her blue hair. I couldn't read anything. I kept going, how does she do that? You know, it's just amazing how a little mind can think. But when you have a hearing loss and you don't get that connection, mentally, you step back. You just step back. I mean, I didn't learn a lot of things until I got older. In fact, I still don't know much of anything.
This is just a really powerful, you know, conversation right now, because how many people can, who are out there listening and, you know, watching, who can really relate to you right now. So thank you for sharing everything that you're.
Good. I can leave now.
No, you absolutely cannot.
No, this is amazing.
Randy thinks he's the boss.
You know, it's like we learn child development in school. You know, I mean, as a psychology major, having my graduate degree in psych, where it's like you learn child development, you know, even in my bachelor program, and maybe from what I remember in high school, I can't remember, but more so when I got into my collegiate career, and I call it a career because it's like still there. But we did. We took classes on child development. So what you're sharing with me, it's like there are those little developmental stages, like you said earlier, between 0 and 5. That's where your brain is starting to absorb. And that's when they say, if you want to learn a new language, you know,
Yeah.
Do it before 2 years old. Otherwise, good luck.
Yeah. Well, and Kathy, what we're talking about here clinically is called, I'm sure you know this, it's layered trauma, because there's no rule that says you only get one trauma, you know, one per person. You know, you had this.
It would have been nice.
It would have been. But I think things are coming into better focus in our conversation, because you're born with this issue. I mean, when I see a kid in a wheelchair, I get choked up, mm-hmm. because that was me as a kid. And you're right. My mom held that information from me. Your parents held the information from you, because it's ugly. It's uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. They don't want to talk about it. That was kind of at least the generation I grew up. You're probably younger than me, but same kind of idea. And then this ugly thing with your dad, who should be a dad and protecting you and watching out for you and beating up the bullies and the abusers, he becomes the abuser. Mm-hmm. Where does a little girl go? You know, that's all.
You go to the woods
with life.
You go to the woods and you hide. But I got to tell you, my hiding in the woods woke him up.
Oh, it did?
Yeah, because you couldn't find me.
Tell us about that.
Yeah.
It got to the point where I would be gone and I'd wait until the sun would come down, because I know my mom's coming home now. And I would wait. But he never knew where I was all day long. And so it got to be scary for him, because it's like, where's this kid? But it was a wake-up call for him. It's like, where is she? Where is she? My dad was not an evil man. He was a good person. He made some bad choices. And I can honestly say, and I'm not making excuses for anybody, my mother was not a good wife. She wasn't a caring, loving person. My dad would come in to give her a kiss on the cheek. She'd turn her face. You go to grab her hand, she pulled away. She didn't really like him. And I think my dad was looking for power. I think he was looking for his significant. Not that I'm, like I said, I'm not making excuses. But if you look at the whole picture, it's not just about what you went through. It's also about what the other person is going through. Mm-hmm. You know, and I couldn't connect with my mom. And when I went to confront her when I was older, she called me a liar. She didn't believe it would happen. And that's because why didn't you come to me? That could be the attitude. You know, I couldn't go to her. She wasn't somebody I can go to. And she didn't know how, she had her own stories. She had her own ignorance. She didn't get an education. The great thing about life, it's not about you. It's about how you handle other people's talking toward you. Do you want to hold on to this shit, or do you want to let it go? Mm-hmm. Do you want it to limit you, or do you want to learn from it? Mm-hmm. You know, every problem in life is not about making drama. The problem is about finding the solution so you can see the strength within yourself and how you can grow in a different way that you never knew.
You know, I think we're seeing some insights into why you're such a great comedian, because where there's great comedy, there's usually great drama or tragedy behind that. And you're growing up in Ohio. We were talking about before we came on, I was born in Ohio, by the way. So I don't know if that's a connection or not, but, you know, a little bit. But, you know, every kid just wants to grow up and be taken care of and have loving parents that protect them and have friends and be accepted and be healthy. You know, my thing was I wanted to be, of course, play sports. And with my condition, I couldn't do it. So that kind of, you know, it's kind of like, you know, I couldn't even finish some of the races because the circulation was so bad. Mm. It just wasn't getting blood places. But as a kid, you know, and what, you know, I really believe strongly we should protect every child.
Definitely.
And care for every child. And every kid deserves to grow up unmolested, healthy, informed, with mature parents that explain what sex is about and what development's about and periods for the young girls and just all these conversations. And I gotta say, I think a lot of society is getting better today, where these topics are not so forbidden and taboo.
It's everywhere, though. It's in the music. It's in the television. It's in the, even the cartoons anymore.
Yeah.
You have to talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We got to talk about it. But, you know, sometimes it gets a little over talked about. But anyway, getting back to the era where we grew up, that wasn't, you know, the conversations aren't what they should have been. And you're just getting layered with this stuff. I'm really intrigued with your statement about your dad. You say he's not evil, mm-hmm. because when I hear about Kathy, if you say to me, "Hey, Randy, let's go rob a bank," I probably won't do it, but let's think about it.
if I say please,
well, it's a temptation. You know, I can relate to that temptation. Mm-hmm. So far, I've never done it. Don't plan on it, if you get my point. But yeah, knock on wood. But when you tell me your dad, who sexually molested you, wasn't evil, mm-hmm. My reaction is like, well, I want to beat the hell out of him. Where is he? You know, I mean, that's infuriating, because I don't get that temptation at all. And I think it's just the sickest, lowest form of expression or behavior in society. That's what I think. Why do you say that? And what would you say to someone like me that just, you know, gets kind of internally enraged with something like
well,
that?
Well, a lot of people want to be protective. See, I believe that every child on this earth is my responsibility. And if everybody believed that, there'd be no harm to any child. And so, but there's something about a child with a disability. A lot of times it's a victim of abuse. It just seems to happen. I was raped when I was 16, didn't even know why, what it was that happened to me. And I look at it like my dad was an alcoholic. He'd been drinking since he was 14, lots of beer. And I blamed the beer. I had to put the blame somewhere. Mm-hmm. I wasn't going to put it on my mom. I had to put it somewhere because it was confusing for me. This person was always helping me. Why would he hurt me? Mm-hmm. You know, he's not a bad person. He's a good person. He's hardworking. He's a good provider. But at the time, I couldn't stand to be around him. You know, my dad loved to dance and stuff. And always would ask me to, no. And when I was 16, he went to pick me up and throw me in a pool, and I beat the shit out of him. And I have no idea why. It seemed like when something traumatic happens to a child, it's like a blackout session or something. You just don't know what it is that happened, but you know the feeling doesn't feel right. And that's part of the suicidal stuff. It's like, why am I not normal? Why don't I want to date? Why do I get uncomfortable with this? How come I don't listen to music like all my friends? How come I can't hear on the phone and everybody else is talking on the phone? So you're asking yourself kinds of questions and nobody's giving you an answer. Mm. So there's that big confusion in life. But as far as my dad was concerned, at the time, no, I didn't want to have anything to do with him. I didn't want him touching me. I didn't want it at that time, but didn't understand why, because I didn't have the memory of what he did, because you black it out. Mm. But you can't black out the emotion that the body developed from the experience. Mm-hmm. You can't black out. It stays in your muscles. Mm-hmm. And like if I see somebody drinking a beer, I get so turned off. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, and then if I see somebody that chews the inside of their mouth, turn off, mm-hmm. because it's just a memory. I don't want to be turned off because it doesn't let me have the opportunity to meet that person. But those were things that my dad did. And I had to learn that if I'm going to have my life, I don't want to carry his ignorance and his stupidity to be a part of my life. So I had to research him.
So these are your triggers. Are you still triggered to this day with these things?
Not as much, no.
Okay.
As much. But there was a time that it would be really bad.
So whether drinking beer triggered you, chewing the inside of someone's mouth, that your dad did that, and that triggered you. What other triggers? Were there any others?
There used to be if somebody were to touch me.
Touch?
Yeah, just touch. It would be like, mm-hmm. you know. What do you want?
Yeah. So there was no hugging or anything with your parents?
None. Like that. There was no hugging. There was no affection in my household.
Okay.
There wasn't that. That's what's so bizarre about me. My mom, whom I'm dealing, not dealing with, but I have the opportunity and the privilege to be there for her right now. She has dementia. And she one time she said, she's only 5'2". And she says, I wish I was more like you. I go, Mom, you're never going to be tall. And so she says, no, I wish I was more loving like you. She goes, where did you get that from? Where did you get that loving, compassionate and hugging and always thinking about the other person? Mm-hmm. Because she's a narcissist, so she doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. And
she lives in LA now?
No, my mom lives in Ohio. I go home every month.
Oh, every month to visit your mom. Yeah. I see. Okay. Thank you.
And, you're welcome. That's all you're going to get. But if you drink a beer in front of me, so help me God, Randy. This is over with.
I'll go with iced tea.
Yeah.
I don't want to trigger you.
Yeah, no, she's 6 feet.
I don't want to trigger piss you. Off Kathy. She's
6 feet. It can get ugly.
Whatever you do. I learned that the hard way. Okay, so where are your brothers through all this? Are they just kind of sidelined?
There was no connection.
No connection. They're just kind of doing their thing.
They're in their own world, you know, doing their thing, you know. I think my brother Mark really went through a difficult time, and he's my older brother. He's just 1 year older than me, and then my baby brother is 7 years older. So Brett got the brunt of the family breaking up from the divorce, and Mark got the brunt of having absolutely no connection with my dad.
Mm.
You know, so he was alone in his own world. It's amazing. That's why I'm so an advocate for communication now. I just want everybody to know that everybody has the right to have their heart be heard.
Yeah.
Especially a child.
Well, you're perfectly modeling this kind of process where you go from kind of a normal baseline. In your case, you thought everything was okay. And then there's probably a moment where you realize things aren't okay on multiple levels. You're not getting any connection with either brother, with your mom or your dad. The kids at school, you feel very alone. You're being molested sexually by your dad, which is as ugly as it can get for a little girl.
You're starting to depress me. You know
well,
that, Randy.
I'm just being real. And then at 16, you're raped, which is horrific. I can't imagine. And it starts making sense why in this dive stage you don't try and commit suicide once, but five times.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just really, frankly, an ugly shit show. Mm-hmm. I mean, of just, you know, life really sucks. Mm-hmm. I mean,
that was my feeling.
Yeah.
What the hell am I here for?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't mean to, you know,
sugarcoat it.
I'm trying to just be real about it, you know, respectful, but real. And, you know, but this helps so many people because they're going through, this stuff is going on today, right now.
Oh, believe right me, now. I know. Yeah. I talk to young people all the time and it's just heartbreaking that they have that emptiness, that loneliness. Why do you think young girls are getting pregnant these days? Everybody's looking for that love, that connection, yeah, yeah. But they don't realize it's sometimes it's the wrong way to go.
Absolutely.
Right. And you mentioned your parents got divorced. How old were you when that happened?
16 years old. It was the happiest day of my life.
Oh, really? Tell us why you say that.
He was out of the house.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He was out of the house.
You felt safe.
No, I never felt safe before either. I felt my baby brother to me was a friend to me because he didn't understand my disability either, but I loved that kid and I wanted to take care. It's like I wanted to save him from this craziness or not. But it didn't bother me at all. Mm. Didn't bother me at all.
Wow.
Less chaos.
Yeah, if it was a connection,
yeah.
If there was a connection and it felt like the family broke up, but it never felt like a family.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel like I lost anything.
So it was a relief for you that the divorce happened.
Because a lot of kids. I was uncomfortable with him in the house.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And it sounds like you weren't all that comfortable with your mom, but you were at least more comfortable relative to your dad.
My mom, you know that I was saying, your bark is worse than your bite.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was my mom. She was a little barker.
Okay. like a chihuahua.
She was a little chihuahua.
Okay. You know, and I'm really glad that you say that too, that you're sharing this, because, you know, I have girlfriends of mine. I grew up here in Dana Point, and, you know, majority of us, like, we've known each other ever since we were like in kindergarten. And I can tell you, there are like a handful of friends of mine that we have recently had these conversations because of domestic violence, et cetera, and abuse and power and control. You said power and control earlier. And majority of them say, oh my gosh, I wish my parents would have gotten a divorce when I was in high school.
And a lot of them don't do it because they think they're saving the kids.
Exactly. And it's
like, they don't realize they're poisoning them because we're still having to see it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you're raising, you know, you're raising an abusive person, or you're raising a victim, because if you grow up in a very unhealthy home, that's all you're going to see. So you grew up in a home where there's no love, no connection, mom pulled away. And that was, that's like your normal. Because it that's
is.
What you saw.
It is your normal. It's yeah, what you know.
That was your normal.
And back then, I hate to say it, but they didn't have, like, I don't even think they breastfeed their babies back then. I think everybody was on formula and that, but there was just none of that
connection.
Yeah. It was that old saying, kids are to be seen and not heard, mm-hmm. or something like that. Mm-hmm. So there was just not that how it was. Nowadays, people have learned there's still a lot of it that's not right mm-hmm. out there. But there's some right, you know. I live in a neighborhood where I have 14 kids that call me Aunt Kathy, and I get to see healthy upbringing.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that I created a safe place at my home for these kids. My door is always unlocked. They think it's funnier than hell that they can come in the house, sneak up on me, and scare the crap out of me because I never hear them come in. So I always tell the parents, look, I want all of you to get together, and we're going to learn CPR. Because this old fart's going to die from one of these kids.
Well, you know, one thing that really strikes me about you, Kathy, is that you've just shared, you know, multiple layers of trauma that most people can't imagine. Maybe one of those things, not two or three, or, you know, it's no surprise you're friends with Jerry Jewell, because her parallel, I'm sure you guys vibe really well because the parallels are so striking. Mm-hmm. But you talk about this. We call it sitting in the fire. It's basically finding a trusted person and sharing your trauma, because a lot of people bottle it in. During this whole period, this is what I'm getting at. During this whole period of growing up with all these layers of garbage and trauma, was there anybody you could talk to about any of this?
No, never opened my mouth about it.
Just bottled up inside.
But you don't realize you're doing it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You're bottling up the emotion, mm-hmm. not the thoughts of mm-hmm. what happened. Mm-hmm. You're just bottling up like what happened. Like when I got raped, I did go to a girl and I said, something happened to me and I'm bleeding now. And she said, oh, you broke your cherry. And I go, I don't have cherries. I didn't know any of these terms mm-hmm. and that. So I didn't know what happened to me. So it's just living a life of questions, like I said, with no answers is confusing. That's why, to me, it's important that you talk to your kids and you listen to them.
Yeah.
Listening is the most important part. Mm-hmm. Without trying to fix anything, mm-hmm. without trying to give them a suggestion right away, let them pour it out.
Yeah.
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 And so with the rape situation at 16, nobody contacted the police. No one was your advocate. Nothing like that.
No, I was alone and I kept it a secret. I kept it a secret because I didn't know what happened.
Yeah,
I didn't understand.
I understand.
Yeah.
But I did confront the guy later on.
You knew this person?
Yeah, it was one of my classmates. Yeah.
Okay. And you confronted him. How old were you when that happened?
I was probably in my, he moved out here, probably in my 40s or
50s. Oh, wow.
Oh, is that really a long time?
I confronted him what happened.
You know, that's, wow. I want to save that mm-hmm. for the next episode, because that sounds like a survival. You're getting back on your feet and having the courage to confront your abusers mm-hmm. and your, these people. But sticking with the dive stage, we'll get to that for sure. Anything else you want to share about this whole ugly episode? How old were you when you left home and went off? Where would you go to college?
I got kicked out when I was 17 and a half.
You were kicked out?
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
I was, my best friend, Lisa, who I spoke about, mm-hmm. she was getting married out of high school. And the best man, I kept telling Lisa, I go, you sure you want to go through this? Because we had all these plans. I don't want this guy in the way. And the best man's name was Mark. And he took me out. And we were having fun. We went bowling and got in the car. And he tried to get fresh with me, you know. And he wanted to touch my boobs. If you can find it, may God bless you can touch it. But because I've been looking for it for years. And I said, what are you doing? And he goes, well, Mary, how did he say? Mary Lou let me touch hers. And I said, well, then go call Mary Lou. Leave me alone. Mm-hmm. And I was uncomfortable with him because I'd never dated. And so I wasn't comfortable with somebody doing that. So one day I was working in a department store. I came home from work and Mark was at my house talking to my mom. And my mom liked him. Well, I just walked right in the house and went into the kitchen to make myself something to eat because Kathy Mark is here. I go, yeah, I didn't invite him. And she said, come and talk to him. I said, no, I'm going to make myself something to eat. I just got back from work. And she got mad at me. Well, Mark had left. And then my mom was standing on a step because she's little. And she's standing on the step and she goes, what's wrong with you? I go, what do you mean? He's a nice guy. Why don't you do? But I couldn't even tell her what he was trying to do because I didn't understand why he was doing it. Mm. And so she got very angry with me. And she got me frustrated. Well, what's the matter with you? What's the matter with you? Kind of thing. And I just wanted her to stop. And I slapped my own mother. Mm. I slapped my mother and I was kicked out.
At 17 and a half. Mm-hmm. What where were you expected 18. To go? What were you, where'd you
I had no idea where I was gonna go, but I had a car. It was an old, remember Oldsmobile?
Yeah,
like a boat.
Well, like we called him the Queen Mary.
Yeah.
So you didn't drive him, you navigated.
I had that car and I drove down to my brother's and I'll never forget. I went down to his place. He said he would let me stay in the house. But it was a patio attached to this little house that they were staying in. And I just went into this space. And I kept thinking, if I cut my arm off, I could bleed to death. And I had all these negative, horrible thoughts about harming myself. Mm-hmm. Just harm. What is wrong with me? Why can't I date like normal people? What is the problem? And then my sister-in-law said she was pregnant, and I just thought, there's no way I can be in this house with these thoughts. I don't want to hurt her baby. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I left, found a house, best place in the world. It was an old Victorian house, and they had about 10 or 11 efficiency suites, you know, just one room suite. Mm-hmm. But everybody in that place was 65 to 90 something years old in this place. They did not want me moving in. Because they were afraid I'd play my music too loud. Mm-hmm. If I did, it was so I could hear the damn thing. And but I never played music. It wasn't my thing. So I ended up living in there.
And how did you support yourself? Where'd you get the money?
I was working at a department store.
Okay.
I was working at a department store at that time.
Were you finished with high school or were you?
I was finished with high school. I was done. By then, I'm like 18. So I graduated from high school. There was no celebration. There was no, got your diploma and left. And then I just lived in my car for a little bit. And then I found that place. Who helped me? Somebody from like social services or something helped me get this apartment.
Okay. And you, with your graduation going back to that, was there a graduation ceremony at your school? Did you go to that?
Yeah, I went there. I went and put the cap and gown on and I just went because I was going with Lisa.
Okay.
You know, and so we got that and then went on my way.
What was if you're going to identify a point where you kind of went from the dive stage to survive and getting back on your feet, where do you think that would be?
When I got run over by the Jeep.
Okay.
It was a wake-up call.
Well, that story, I read about you in the paper when that happened, and it was just unbelievable. And I think that story belongs right here in the dive stage. Mm-hmm. Why don't you share with everybody what happened?
I was, like I said, I was a mimic, a chameleon. And it was my day off work from the department store. I worked in a warehouse. It was perfect for me because I didn't have to hear anybody. I was alone. And it was my day off. I decided to go to the beach, get myself some color.
Mm-hmm. Are you still in Ohio at this point?
Uh-huh. It's off of Lake Erie.
Okay. Gotcha.
From Manhattan Beach.
Okay.
So I went to get color because I'm so white, I could do a commercial for Clorox sometimes. It would be nice if they'd let me. But I went to the beach, and what I would do is I would take a towel and a blanket, and I'd have a boom bath because everybody had a boom bath. Mm-hmm. I don't know why, but I had it, but I looked like everybody else. And I put my blanket down, and I put the boom bath on. But the thing about the boom bath is Lisa, my best friend, loved music. I love Lisa. And I wanted to be a part of a world in any way possible. So remember in the old days, they had those huge speakers? Well, Lisa would have my back up against the speakers and she would sing the song and I would try to figure out the lip movement to the bass to figure out if I can figure out what the song was about. Mm-hmm. And one day I asked her, tried to sing along with her and she's like, oh, Kathy, don't do that. And I'm laying on the beach and the song came on, the boom bath. I remember the beat, the bass. And I'm trying to visualize Lisa's lip. Now, I don't know about you, but do you ever have your instant come out and they said, no, get out of here. Don't do this. Don't do that. You ever have to do that? Listen to it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Something told me to get off the beach because I saw the way the Jeep, the lifeguard Jeep was running around on the beach. So I said, man, somebody's liable to get run over the way this person's riding the beach. But I didn't think anything of it because I felt this bass. And so I laid my head down and it kept telling me, get off the beach. But I was trying to remember Lisa's lips. Do you guys remember that song, Billy, Don't Be a Hero?
Yes.
Remember that song? Yeah. So I'm sitting on the beach and it's like, Billy, don't be a hero. Don't be a hero today. And so I was feeling this song and all of a sudden, I felt all this pressure on my face and it was wet. I opened my eyes. I knew I was under a vehicle. I didn't know where, but something told me to protect my head. And unfortunately, when I did that, I went to put my hand up over my head and the wheels got me on my elbow and took me down. So basically, my upper body was facing south and my lower body was facing north. With somebody over here, I guess was yelling for the lifeguard. She couldn't hear him, so she came back and got me again. So I guess people didn't like that bathing suit for some reason. But so I'm laying there. And I'm laying on the beach. And all of a sudden, I saw the Jeep coming back. And I know this is going to sound bizarre. There was a part of me that felt like I was out of my body watching something happen. And then all of a sudden, I'm on the beach alone. There's nobody with me. But I'm watching this old man walking down on the beach. I'm watching him come toward me. Long beard, white robe, whatever you want to call it. And he sits on my stomach. And he says, Catherine, this isn't going to hurt. You're going to hear a loud pop. I'm going, this fool doesn't know I'm deaf. And so he took his hand and he cupped it over my nose. And I heard it. I heard the pop. And he said, everything's going to be all right. And I'm looking at this person. And it's not like, I don't know how to explain it. You know, I believe that I died that day on the beach. At least I did. And it's not like you die and you go to heaven and you see God and you go, hey, God, nice robe, lose the sandal, not happening. You know, it's not a conversation. It's a knowing. It's familiar. So when he got up to walk away, I was surrounded in this amazing blue I have yet to see on this earth. And then out of the blue came this phenomenal bright white cloud. And I have this thing about cloud now because of it. And out of the cloud came a hand. And I thought it was my cousin Mary Lou, who had passed away. She was murdered. And so I thought it was her because she had the most beautiful hands I've ever seen. And then the hand turned into the most, and it wasn't about the hand, it was about the feeling that came with it. Mm-hmm. And I kept saying, no, I'm not ready yet. I'm not ready. And when I said that, all of a sudden, everything disappeared. And I got a board under me, a neck brace on me, and my hand was still up in the air. And when I saw my hand, they were trying to get it down. And when I saw it, I brought it back down and they strapped me to the board. And so I got into the ambulance. And the cute thing was, I laugh now, but at the time, not so much. But the right on my right side, there was this gentleman who kept doing this to my hand, squeezing it. Apparently, with this paramedic's first day, and they were testing him, of course, on my time. And he went to take my pulse, couldn't get a pulse. He put something under my nose, nothing. He laid his head on my chest to hear my heartbeat or something. And I was like, oh, thank you. But I just got run over. I'm not in the mood. But nothing to do with a headache, okay? It's just all about the Jeep. And so I'm laying there. And I distinctly remember, and I don't know how I heard this, but I distinctly remember 3:45 dead on arrival. And they put the sheet over my face. Now, in the meantime, this guy is still squeezing my hand. But I have no idea why the sheet is on my face. So I start blowing on it to get it off. And I said, excuse me, could you please get the sheet off my face? And the young paramedic threw himself up against the back of the, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. All the way to the hospital. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. They're wheeling me into the emergency room. All you can hear is this young paramedic. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And I'm just like, go home already, will you?
Shut up.
And I'm in intensive care, and you hear this face on the window going, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. And he was just, bless his heart. And I just kept saying, it's okay, it's okay. I think the hardest part for me was the emergency doctor. I think he was 190 years old. And he had a little black pocket book in his pocket, and it kept dropping, and it was on the floor. That became my focus, not what I was going through. But that book became my focus. And when I started realizing my body, because I didn't feel anything, I didn't feel pain. I didn't feel much of anything at that time. And I don't know if it's because your adrenaline goes too high or what, but when they started poking me, you know, because I started coughing up black stuff, I didn't know that when you have internal bleeding, your blood is black when it comes out. I just assumed it was going to be red. Mm-hmm. And because it wasn't red, it didn't scare me. I didn't know what it was. And so in the meantime, they were trying to get an IV in me. They poked me 14 times. Couldn't get an IV. And they finally got the IV in, but they didn't cap it. So my blood's going out. I don't know how I managed to do this, but I put my finger on it until I could find the cap. They couldn't get a catheter in me. They kept having these big ones. And, you know, I'm very small and delicate. And so they finally got the right one in. And I am now in intensive care. Nobody's allowed to visit me. I'm all alone. The nurse kept going, do you want this tube down your throat? But she didn't say why. So, of course, I'm going to say no. And so then the doctor came in and goes, how come it was supposed to suck out the blood that I was coughing mm-hmm. up the whole time, right. which really was bitter. And he came in and shoved that tube down my throat, didn't even ask. I go, at least she asked. And I was just so not knowing what's going on. Mm-hmm. But intensive care, everybody had a mask on. So I had no idea what was going on with me. For 13 days, I don't know why, but these people would come in every day, look at my body, take off my nightgown or whatever you call the hot butter gown and take off the blanket. Now I'm not comfortable in my body. Mm-hmm. And you have like 5-6 people around your bed. And they're looking at all the tire tracks. And I'm thinking, it's on my face. Just look at my face. But they did this every day, 4 or 5 times a day. Different people would come in. How are you supposed to rest?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it got to the point where I would watch that door. And as soon as that door would open up, I would turn my head and just tears, you know, and, mm-hmm. and wait for them to be done with it. And sometimes they leave and they didn't cover me up. And I had to wait for a night nurse or somebody to come in and cover me up. Well, the 13th day, the door opens up. I turn my head. And I'm like waiting. They went to grab the blanket. I pulled it up. Somebody was touching my forearm ever so gently. And I opened my eyes, and right there was this chubby face, angelic face. She had these big, thick glasses. I think her eyes were green, strawberry blonde hair, and she didn't have a mask on. My first pair of lips in 13 days. And she goes, "How you doing?" Well, I can't talk because I have tubes down my throat. She goes, "How you doing?" And I look and she goes, "Do you need anything?" She's asking me questions. I'm going, she can't see. There's a tube down my throat because her glasses are too thick. And the whole time I want to tell her something. And she just kept stroking my forearm so gently. Nobody touched me like that the whole time. But she said the magic words. "You know you're going to be okay, right?" And I needed to see that. And she went to walk away, and she's going out the door, and all I kept thinking in my head, "Lock the door, will you lock it?" But I ended up the 14th day, I think it was, and they took me into a shower because I still had sand all over me. They weren't worried about keeping me clean. They were worried about keeping me alive, apparently. So I'm in the shower, and I swear I was in it for like 40 some minutes. And they kept coming in. "Are you done yet?" "No." And I'm in this wheelchair in the shower, and I'm just taking it all in.
It must have felt great. Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I was in heaven in that moment. That was the one time I started feeling alive. Mm-hmm. And they wheeled me to my room, and I was sitting by the window, and I'll never forget this. I'm like, "God, please, don't forsake me like this. I can't live like this. I'll be lip-reading nose hair for the rest of my life." Looking up at people, you know, and I was scared. Yeah. I was scared. And then that's how it went.
Wow. Well, I think, how old were you when you were run over by a Jeep at the beach?
20.
And that was a turning point.
And I was laid up for 5 years in and out of a wheelchair for 2.5 years. They said I'd never walk again. I figured I didn't hear him. I got up and I left.
Wow.
There's benefits for every disability.
So if you think you're having a bad day, that is.
I was just talking about this today at this luncheon that I was speaking at. I go, you know, whenever you're feeling that you're having a bad day, get on YouTube, look at Instagram videos, and watch the people who don't have legs, who don't have arms, who are driving because they, you know, they have capability, but they are paralyzed waist down, taking their, you know, taking their wheelchair, putting it together and assembling it. It's like, yeah, it makes you go, my life's not that bad.
Or you could just talk to Kathy Buckley.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm depressed the hell out of you.
Exactly, right?
Well, no, that, you see, I mean, what keeps us going is I know where your story ends, and it's really, really cool. But to hear, I mean, I knew about the Jeep story, and I watched some YouTube videos about you before you, because Jerry Jules always bragged about you, and David Zimmerman, our friend, you know, I know where you end up, but to realize that you went through this
all
the way up to 20, and a lot of people would have just been absolutely crushed with what you went through. Mm-hmm. And then you went through that on top of it. It's like, what did I do wrong to deserve this whole parade of trauma?
Yeah.
but we're going to go there.
Yeah. And no fault to anybody's own, you know. Let me ask you one question before we, you know, go into the next segment. After the Jeep accident, did you ever go into that dark tunnel and wanting to take your own life again? Or was it kind of just, that was your turning point?
It's basically kind of a wake up call. Mm-hmm. Because now you're in survivor mode.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Do you want to go? Do you not? You're in survival mode. Yeah. You're just fighting for something. And to be honest with you, I don't know why I went into fighting mode. I mean, I was on welfare for $100 a month is what I got paid. My rent was $80. Can you imagine something being $80 for a month?
Goodness.
In that old house that I was living in. And somebody told me that fish was brain food. And I actually believe if I eat enough fish, I could keep my brain alive and my legs would follow through for me. Mm-hmm. And I took an old jacket. And I just put pockets on the inside so that when I went to the grocery store, I could steal cans of tuna fish. And the ironic thing is one day the pocket gave way and I'm rolling down the aisle and there's three cans of tuna fish following me. I'm like, oh, shit. I got busted. And that, back then, they didn't know where to put a wheelchair in a cop car. But they got me to the station. I'll never forget this officer. His name was Kevin. He goes, aren't you the young lady that ran over at Manor Headland Beach? I go, yeah. He goes, are you hungry? I go, yeah. You ordered me pizza and milk. Mm. I had my mug shots taken with mozzarella cheese and a milk mustache. I never stole it again. But if you come in my house, you always find a can of tuna fish somewhere in the house to remind me how blessed I am.
Oh, I just got chills on that one.
Yeah. I think there's more chills coming.
Yeah.
Well, Kathy Buckley, it is wonderful to meet you in person after hearing about you all this time. And that is profound.
Yes.
I think it's time to move from dive to survive. Yep. So let's come back in the next episode and do that on Post-Traumatic Thriving, where we talk about dive, survive, or thrive.
The choice is yours.
I don't know. I thought I could go home now.
You're stuck here.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-Traumatic Thriving is produced by CoreIQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the life skills we all need but are not taught in school. CoreIQ and the Post-Traumatic Thriving podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.